Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Get ready for all the craziness of small business. It's exactly that craziness that makes it exciting and totally unbelievable. Small Business Radio is now on the air with your host, Barry Moltz.
Well, thanks for joining this week's radio show. Remember, this is the final word in small business. For those keeping track, this is now amazingly show number 725. It's sponsored by Truly Financial, banking that puts money back into your business. Get a free copy of my new book, Change Masters, how to actually make the changes you already know you need to make by signing up for a free account. Go to www.trulyfinancial.com/Barry. Well, think about it. Are you a super fan for any product brand you buy? For me, it's Specialized Bicycles. It's Icebreaker Clothing. Super fans like me are critical for spreading the word and how fantastic your brand is. So how do you create super fans and support them? My next guest is Brittany Hodak, who is obsessed with helping people turn their customers into super fans. Brittany co-founded, scaled, and successfully exited the Superfan Company, a fan engagement company whose roster included Walmart, Disney, Amazon, Katy Perry, Johnson & Johnson, and Dolly Parton. She originated the role of Chief Experience Officer at Experience.com. When she appeared on the hit TV show Shark Tank, she received six-figure offers from four of the five sharks. Her first book is called Creating Superfans, is in stores this month. Brittany, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Barry. I'm stoked to be here.
Well, of course, which shark didn't offer you anything?
Mark Cuban.
Mark Cuban, the only shark.
Can you believe it?
You know, one of the two sharks I've actually met in person, him and Barbara Cochran. So Mark didn't offer you anything, huh? How come?
He did not. No, I think he was having a bad day.
He was having a bad day. Listen, we all have a bad day. So why'd you get involved with this thing called Superfans, and why is it important for small business owners?
So I grew up really wanting to work in the music industry. And like you, I loved radio. My first job was actually at a radio station in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And I just loved bands. I loved trying to understand why some artists, you know, became superstars and others sort of faded away. So I knew I wanted to work in entertainment. I worked for several record labels and entertainment companies. But what I started to realize as I started working with brands is that the exact same things that make someone care about their favorite musician can help someone care about a brand. The principles are exactly the same. The psychology is exactly the same. So I started applying some of the principles of the entertainment world to help brand partners create superfan customers. And once I started doing that, I was hooked.
Okay, so before we get that, I went back a long time ago when I wrote my second book, Bounce, I was very interested in why there are one-hit wonders. Why does a band have one hit and that's it? Versus you have someone like Bruce Springsteen that has hit after hit after hit. Did you ever think about that?
I thought about that a lot. And so here's what I think the answer is. And this is true in music and this is true in the brand world. Super fans are created at the intersection of your story and your customer stories. It's a two-way street, right? I think with one-hit wonders, the biggest problem is often apathy. People just don't care enough to care about the next song. There's nothing about that first song that's made them say, I want to know more. I care about the next single that this artist puts out. right? Because if there's no connection there, if it's just filler, if it's just entertainment on the radio, then they don't care about that artist. They just care about the next song that's going to entertain them for 3 minutes. So the artists that find the most success and longevity are the ones who are interesting enough to connect with their customers or their listeners and keep them engaged long term.
It's interesting what you talk about here. You said super fans are really at the intersection of your story and your customer story. And that seems to me a lot easier now with the internet, because we really can get inside of the company. For me, that's why I think that, again, during the pandemic, the Peloton instructors became so popular, because we got to kind of go inside their homes, literally, when they couldn't exercise in the studio, and we learned all about them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, social media is such a powerful tool, and video is such a powerful tool for people to really feel like they know you better. And, you know, one of the principles I talk about in this book is that your brand isn't just your logo. And in fact, your brand isn't what you say it is. Your brand is what customers are telling their friends about you. And absolutely, I think we've seen a huge shift in just the past 2-3 years, as you said.
So you talk about your story and your customer story. First of all, what's the best way to tell your story?
Well, the best way to tell your story is going to vary based on what your story is. So there are some things that are going to be the same for everyone. So making sure that you're, you know, being authentic, making sure that you're meeting your customers where they're at. But really, the secret formula here is that there's not a secret formula, because everyone is different. Everybody's story is different. Every brand exists for, you know, presumably a slightly different reason. So I always tell people to start by thinking about your superpower. Why does your brand exist? What are you the best in the world at? And what is it that you can do to improve your prospects and your customers' lives in some way?
And what's the best way to tell your customer story? Are you telling that story, or are you encouraging your customers to tell their story?
So I always encourage active listening. And this is regardless of your role in the company. When you're talking to a customer, your goal should be to learn as much about them as possible. So I talk about this balance of empathy and authority. So often, whether in sales or customer service or even marketing, we are so tempted to lead with authority, to let people know everything that we know. But, you know, there's this really great quote that I love from Teddy Roosevelt: people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So in the book, I talk about the idea of leading with empathy rather than authority, and using that empathy and curiosity to really uncover things about your customers that you might not otherwise learn about them.
You know, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, and unfortunately, they're not interested in telling their story, their company story, because they feel like they're more private or they don't want to brag about it. But I don't think telling a story is necessarily bragging about it. It's just to let people know who you are and why you're doing what you're doing.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, I always say that the biggest problem that doesn't get nearly enough press is apathy. It's people who don't care. And the reason people don't care is because you haven't given them a reason to. You haven't shown them how you're different from anybody else. And for startup founders, this is so important. And you don't have to overshare. You don't have to share any details about your life that, you know, you're uncomfortable putting out there. But what you do have to do is have a narrative that gets somebody interested and gets them curious. Because if you're not doing that, then you're just another forgettable founder with a forgettable product that they're not going to think about again, because you haven't hooked them in any way.
And so do you think this then ties into content marketing? Because, you know, I'm a big fan of Patagonia, and they do a lot of content marketing around. They're not going to try to sell you the next jacket. They're talking about, here are the women explorers that we want you to know more about.
Oh, 100% it ties into content marketing. And Patagonia is an amazing example of a brand that's leading with that value and giving you value. And maybe you'll buy their products, and that's great, but they really want to add value. And one thing that I think more and more entrepreneurs are starting to understand is that a huge amount of a customer's journey or a prospect's journey is happening before anyone reaches out. Like, think about the way that you buy. You're doing research, you're making lots of decisions, by the time you ever reach out to a company, whether that's to place an order or talk to a salesperson or get more information, you're already so far along on that journey. So entrepreneurs oftentimes don't think about all of the prospects that they're losing before they ever even know who they are, like before they ever even opt into any communication from the company. And that's why content marketing is so critical, because if you do a good job sharing your story and creating value, people are going to be very highly qualified by the time they actually do initiate a conversation with you.
And here's the best part. Super fans will tell other people that can become super fans. I think everyone strives to be a brand like Apple or Harley because you're a Harley person or you're an Apple person, and that's part of your identity, Brittany.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I always say that anybody can create super fans. I'm a super fan of my exterminator, Scott. I'm a super fan of a gentleman who just came and painted my downstairs. Anybody, whether you're in a service business or a product business, if you focus on customer experience, you will create super fans. You will create people who want to evangelize for you and want to advocate for you because, you know, by nature, Barry, I believe that all humans want to be helpful, right? We want to help each other. We want to let our friends in on the things that we've found out about that we think are great because we want to make their lives better. So if you're making your customers' lives better in some way, they're going to spread the word because they want to help their friends and family members and colleagues and other people they care about have better lives too.
You bring up the words customer experience, and unfortunately, some people call it customer service. And most companies, I believe, especially in the United States, Brittany, pay lip service to those words. How do you make sure that the customer experience is the best it can be for your customers? Because I really believe that's really your competitive advantage.
Oh, I'm 100% in agreement with you that that's a competitive advantage. And you're right. So many people use customer experience and customer service interchangeably. And customer service is just one very small facet of customer experience. But the reality is everyone at your company works in the experience department. Every single person, whether you are the founder, CEO, or an intern who's on your third day, once you have on that name tag for the company, whether that's a literal name tag or a metaphorical name tag, you are the brand. And to customers, you represent everything about that brand. So customer experience is, I think, the most important investment that you can make, because whether somebody is on the front end of a transaction, the back end, or somewhere in the middle, they are either influencing whether or not the first sale is going to happen or whether the next sale is going to happen. And, you know, so many people think about customer retention as something that you don't have to think about until right before the renewal or right before somebody's about to, you know, rate shop you with a competitor. But the reality is customer retention should start even before you have that customer. You should be creating an experience that's so enjoyable and so helpful that your customers would never dream of going to work with anybody else.
Right, it's one of the barriers to exit. And people do talk about their customer experiences, positive and negative. We all know people talk a lot more about their negative experiences than positive experiences. I had a problem with my Google Nest thermostat. I called up customer service and it was an incredible experience. The woman at the other end actually knew, Brittany, what she was talking about. She didn't have to look everything up. And so I'm much more likely to go buy another Google product because I had that great experience.
Yeah. And, you know, I love that example because so often businesses look at their, let's say, call center or wherever they have a collection of customer service people, whether that's doing help desk tickets, whether that's a call center, whether that's people working at retail, and they make them low paid jobs, or they say, oh, well, I can train anyone to do this. And I always say, you know, I can train anyone to get a little bit better at basketball, but they're not going to be LeBron James. Right. They're not going to be Steph Curry. If you want your brand to really, you know, create those kinds of emotional connections with customers, if you want people to think of you in the same, you know, way that they think about brands like Apple or that experience that you had with Nest, you've got to look for those VIPs. You've got to hire people who are already customer centric and train them and give them, you know, the power, enable them to really become even more customer centric, because that's your brand. That's what people are going to remember about you. Isn't, you know, how the thermostat worked necessarily. It's the experience that you had when you tried to get help with that product in your home.
You know, one of the biggest difficulties a lot of small business owners face is, how do you get your employees aligned with your brand story? And the first thing when they ask me that question is, well, what is your brand story? Have you communicated that to your employees?
Yeah, exactly. And if you don't know your brand story, how are you ever going to expect your employees to know it? And if they don't know it, how are your customers ever going to be able to figure it out? So in the book, I talk about what I call the supermodel. It's a 5-part framework that lets you really start to think about, what is your uniqueness? What is it that your brand is absolutely the best in the world at? Or if you're not currently the best in the world at anything, what can you start to work toward becoming the best at? Because the reality is, like, you can no longer build a sustainable long-term business by saying we're the cheapest or we're the fastest or we're the closest to your home, because the barriers to entry have never been lower for competitors to come in and compete on all of those things. So if you really want to find long-term success, you've got to move from being somewhat of a commodity provider in the minds of your customers to a category of one, to that category leader. And that starts with getting clarity on your story. And then, to your point, you've got to then have that story come alive to all of your employees. It's got to be more than just a paycheck to them. It's got to be a purpose. They've got to feel aligned with whatever problem it is that you're solving, whatever it is that you're doing to make life that much better for your customers.
But again, what's the brand story? Because I remember when in Chicago, you'll see these people gas trucks, and it says People's Gas on it. But one of the things it also says is making homes warmer for 100 years, right? They're not providing gas. They're providing an environment where people can live and that they're comfortable. That's part of their story.
I love that. Yes. And it's that warmth, even, you know, the word warmth has so much connotation around it visually. But yes, and that's ultimately what you've got to get at for your story is, what is the root purpose? What are you doing to improve the lives of your customers? Because if you're not improving their lives in some way, why do you exist? Like, what do they need you for? That's what you've ultimately got to get to, is you need to care about us because of what we're doing that matters to you.
Right. And you have to understand what the mission is beyond just making money. I always do this test for small business owners. I want you to go out. I want you to bring 5 people in and say, what does our company do? And do they all say the same thing? Mostly all of them say different things, and they don't really have the brand story. They say, well, you know, we're landlords, or, well, we sell food. Well, that's not really what we do. It can't be.
Yeah. And, you know, I love that test. And I would say with a lot of businesses out there, you might get the same results if you ask 5 of your employees. And then that's, like, really a problem, because if your employees aren't all even on message, you've got very little hope of ever having a cohesive brand story with your customers, which means if your customers are telling their friends about you, they may not be saying what you want them to say.
Absolutely. Well, the title of the book is called Creating Superfans. Brittany, where can people get a copy of the book and learn about the work you're doing?
You can find the book anywhere books are sold. You can order them online or go pick them up at your favorite bookstore. And you can find more information on my website at brittanyhodak.com.
Brittany, thanks again. This is AMA 20 WCPT in Chicago. We'll be right back. I just hate the way big banks treat small businesses. They're always a gotcha. High fees, no rewards, minimum balances. So what's in it for you? Now comes a bank that gets small businesses. Truly Financial gives you a corporate Visa card, a checking account, and up to 2.5% cash back on every single dollar your business spends. That's why I'm partnering with them to bring you a special offer. Go to trulyfinancial.com/Barry and learn about how you can get all these benefits for your company and get a free copy of my new book, Change Masters, How to Make the Changes You Already Know You Need to Make When You Open an Account. So go to trulyfinancial.com/Barry and truly spelled T-R-U-L-Y and get a free copy of my book, Change Masters.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Well, over the years, I've helped a lot of family businesses since they face special challenges running a company together. In fact, my next book is going to be about family business. But first, my next guests are third-generation siblings that run Grebner, who has served clients in the natural gas industry, particularly in utilities and contractors. Carissa Skorczewski and Kirk Grebner have joined forces to successfully run and progress their family business. Carissa and Kurt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you so much for having us, Barry. We're happy to be here.
And Carissa, let me get your last name again. Skorczewski, is that right?
That's it.
All right, good. So, Carissa, let me ask you, how did the business come to you as third generation? How did it get started? And now, why are you guys in charge?
Yeah, great question. Well, we're humbled to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to meet with you. Love how you're involved in these different small businesses all across the country. It's pretty amazing. But our grandfather started the company 46 years ago, and he, you know, really was starting it in an effort to just provide better customer service in kind of a complicated industry, and started as a manufacturer's rep representing manufacturers. And he was approached by one of our key manufacturers a couple years later to potentially stock the product. So that's when our dad got involved with the business. So the two of them started it, and it's, you know, grown from there. But growing up, Kurt and I were encouraged to get experience outside of the family business so that if we wanted to work in the family business, if we came to the family business, essentially, it was because we, you know, wanted to and felt like it was a good decision for our family and for the employees and the business. And so Kurt and I actually, you know, had 10 plus years outside. You know, we still worked kind of those summer jobs in the warehouse and helping out stocking products or data entry, things like that, but had full careers outside before we got started.
So Carissa brings up a really good point. I think one of the keys to a successful family business is for folks to have experience outside of their family business. Is this something that your father and your grandfather encouraged you to do? And did you do it willingly, or did you just want to go into the business right away?
So it was interesting for me growing up. I never really felt any pressure or direction towards the family business at all. It was something that I had always been, you know, seen through our father. But it wasn't on my mind at all as this is what I'm going to do with my career. And really, I think a lot of that was that our dad was a salesman at his core, and that is not really something that's necessarily in our blood. I personally know that I would make a terrible salesman, and that's just, you know, that's just the personality type and the work style that I have. And so I think seeing that and projecting that onto myself, going, you know, okay, this really maybe isn't the path for me. I'm a numbers guy. I want to study math and things like that. And ultimately, I morphed that into an accounting degree and went to go work at a CPA firm for 8 years. And that at the time was the right fit for me. And so it really wasn't until later on that the business had grown a lot. There was need for a lot of new skill sets at the business. And our dad started looking more towards a succession path and started approaching us to see if maybe we would be interested in, you know, seeing where we fit in to that path in the future, that we started to re-envision things a little bit. And we were both very lucky that the skills and background that we had picked up along the way ended up really adding a lot of value to the business, which we wouldn't have picked up if we had just jumped right in out of school.
You know, Kurt, there's another key there of what your father said. Well, he's looking to succession, because I find that a lot of family business owners don't look succession. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to pry the business out of their cold, dead hands when they die. But Carissa, how did your father bring it up to you, and I guess to Kurt, and was it done simultaneously, that I really want you to come in the business, I really want you to succeed me, and I really want this family business to keep going?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think our families blessed to be good communicators. So, you know, for my career, I was in large corporate companies for more than 10 years working on strategy, P&L management, things of that nature. So I was more on the big side and really, you know, was at a point in my career where I was wanting to have, you know, more of an impact, and more of an impact on the community and with the team. So when I was in that, you know, those roles, and our dad was trying to kind of figure out what to do, Kurt and I actually started attending with our dad that he found through his network in the Twin Cities here, a local college that has a family business center, which does a really great job connecting family businesses, talking about succession, figuring out what might be a potential good path for each family. And so they have monthly family business breakfasts. And so Kurt and I started attending those even when we were in our other careers, which was really good to meet other people, to listen to panel discussions, to discuss with our parents what might be right for our family and for the business going forward. So I feel that was really instrumental in kind of having, for me at least, to take the leap of faith to go into the business, because for us, it's family first. And so, to be honest, I was a little concerned about working with my dad and what that could mean for blurred lines between family and business and work-life balance and, you know, whatever that looks like. So it was helpful to kind of start in this network so it could bring up those themes and some topics that we maybe wouldn't have otherwise thought about on our own.
So, Kurt, how did you guys choose roles when your father came calling? Because I find that choosing specific roles is really important for a family business. Did you want to be CEO, or you just said to Carissa, hey, you take it, I don't want it, it's like a hot potato?
Well, we're actually pretty lucky that the two of us, and really the three of us with our dad included, have very different skills from each other, you know, partly from our backgrounds, but partly from our personality types too. And we did a lot of work on the front end as we were getting settled in our new roles. You know, we came in with, here's what my background is. I'm good with numbers and accounting, so I'm going to fall into that spot. But we also did some personality assessments. We worked a lot with a family business advisor and a large group of advisors over a several year period as we were you know, working our way into our future roles to kind of see what dynamics work best between each other and as a group. And it luckily all kind of fell into place pretty clearly on what Chris is good at, what I'm good at. And that has made it easy for us to have a good balance between each other. You know, I'm a little bit more of a put my head down and crunch numbers type of a person. I look really closely and deep into specific topics and like to kind of have that tunnel vision and have the deep dive analysis, whereas Chris sees things a lot more big picture and can oversee the company as a whole and bring those ideas together and decide what it means from a strategic standpoint. So I think we have a good balance there. So far it's worked great, and knock on wood, that'll keep going that way.
So, Carissa, Kurt brings up a good thing about the money. How did the ownership of the company, or has the ownership of the company passed from the second generation to third generation? And what happens to the kids that aren't involved in the business? Do they have a financial interest in the business?
Yeah, that's definitely a big topic. And I wanted to circle back to the last question because it made me... I laughed a little bit because when I decided to join the family business, after talking to my dad a lot, I actually made him interview me because I felt like he didn't maybe know all of the things that I did in my corporate jobs. And it's true. He didn't. So I updated my resume and I made him interview me, and I wanted him to see, you know, kind of what I had done in the past and potential value I could bring to the organization with where it was at today. So I think that was really helpful for when I onboarded, and Kurt started about 6 months after me. So the transition was good. So I laughed when Kurt was talking about that with the skill sets, because I did make him interview me. But to your point about the financials, that always is a really challenging piece for a lot of businesses, as you know better than anybody. And I think our network through the Family Business Center really helped. And we ended up hiring a consultant that works specifically on different potential exit planning strategies. So she worked closely with our dad to kind of look at every potential way, and really with my dad and my mom about their, you know, what were their hopes for retirement? What would everything look like? So we really needed to divide everything up in two pieces. One was the people leadership and one was the ownership itself. So I've been at the company coming up on 5 years here, and I'd say the first, you know, 3 years we really focused on the people leadership and transitioning the day-to-day operations from our dad over to Kurt and me and what that looks like. And then once they transitioned over to presidency and took those pieces off, then we could really dive in full steam ahead on the ownership. So for us, it's, you know, what's best for the company, but also what's best for our family and moving to the third generation. So I have majority ownership with the, you know, value that it can bring for the organization to have our Women Business Enterprise certification. And then Kurt has the rest. And so really it was just a lot of conversations and working with that exit planning strategist to figure that out, to transition things forward. Lots of meetings with accountants, lots of meetings with lawyers, and just bringing up all those icky questions that are harder to bring up later. But let's just talk about all of it up front so that we all feel comfortable where we're at.
Yeah, it seems like you got some really good advice. I just want to follow up then, Carissa. So you've got a majority because you're a woman business and enterprise, and Kurt has a minority. Does your father and mother still own any of the business? And is there any other siblings you have that own any of the business?
Yeah, they do not. So it's just Kurt and me. We're the only siblings, and we both work in the business.
That makes
so
it easier. That makes it easier.
It does, for sure. But we did do a lot of, you know, paperwork and legal documents, just knowing that that's how it is today, but it might not be how it is in the future. So what do buyout clauses look like? You know, what does it look like in the chance that one of us gets divorced in the future? You know, we literally looked at every scenario just to make sure that we keep the business in the family. It was really important to us, regardless of kind of where our paths take us. But no, effective the first of this year, Kurt and I, I'm 51, he's 49% owner. So we have the full ownership, and our parents do not own the business, but no other siblings. So that does make it easier.
And Kurt, I bring this up because this is very important for a lot of family-owned businesses. Because Carissa talked about their retirement, how are they going to support themselves? Did you actually have to pay them for the business, or is a certain amount of money coming out of the business to support them for a certain period of time? How'd you work all that out?
Yeah, so we set that up. It's a more of a deferred compensation type of a setup, and essentially, we've agreed to keep paying a salary to our dad for the indefinite future, and we know, you know, he'll continue adding value with that. But as his hours dwindle and he fades off into the sunset a little bit more, it'll start looking like more of an overpay as time goes on.
Right, for his retirement.
We're totally on board with that. Yeah. So we know that we have been extremely fortunate, and because of that, we've let him really dictate, you know, your needs come first in all of this, and whatever you know is left over, we're happy to take the reins on. And we've been lucky as well. Our business is closely involved with several others that have branched off in the industry through the years that our father has been instrumental in starting to run, that have essentially been either a different customer solution through Grebner that we've chosen to start a new entity, or incubated within Grebner and then branched off separately. So he still has a fair amount of ownership in other little endeavors that are keeping him busy along the way. And he'll have plenty to help him through his retirement for
yeah,
sure.
Interesting. He's still busy. Chris, so one last question I want to ask you is, I find that a lot of small businesses and family-owned businesses don't really know how to make the difficult decision, or they don't know how to take the tough decision. How do decisions get made inside Grebner now?
It's a great point. So we have an executive team here, and so we have quarterly strategic planning meetings with key other individuals on the team, other VPs, to make sure that we have a good representation of the different areas of the organization. And then as, our dad continues to progress into this mentorship role, as well as other key employees that are still with the company that, you know, will approach retirement in the next few years, we'll likely set up a board of directors in the future that would also provide us the opportunity to have other contractors or utility partners, vendors, you know, retired utility executives, partners that we've worked with over the years that are still looking to be involved in the industry, that we really value their expertise, and they could be, you know, involved in a capacity to help us with our strategic initiatives. So for now, our dad is still involved in, you know, some of the strategic planning meetings. You know, we have key executives in our different branches. We have four different branches across the country. So we feel like we have, you know, really good support from the team. We have on the full team, we have over 650 years industry experience. So Kurt and I are really grateful coming in new with that outside perspective, that we're able to lean on this great team to help us with the overall decision making and operations. And we can focus on the ownership and bringing this outside perspective that we come with to kind of help get this, which was, you know, a small business family startup, hopefully continue to grow and take it to the next level.
Well, it really seems like you guys have really done it right. The last question I want to ask both of you, have you ever seen the TV show Succession? And you're glad you're not that family.
I have watched every episode of that. And yeah, it was kind of funny because as that was coming out was right as we were going through this whole process. So yeah, I found a lot of pretty humorous parallels there. But luckily, we've avoided most of those pitfalls that they've come across.
You're not then.
Ways to learn, right?
Exactly. Well, Chris and Kurt, I appreciate being on the show. Carissa, where can people learn more about Grebner?
We are at Grebner.com, GROEBNER.com.
Chris and Kurt, thanks again. This is AM 820 WCPT in Chicago. We'll be right back. Did you know that you can lose up to 5% on an invoice just because it's an international wire transfer? I know a lot of people are dealing with the same nonsense, and for small business owners, it hurts. I was dealing with the same painful fees too until I found Truly Financial. I like that they're the everyday global bank that business owners actually need. In fact, I like them so much that I'm partnering with them to bring you this special offer. Open a Truly Financial account and get a free copy of my new book, Change Masters, how to actually make the changes you already know you need to make. It's time to start saving on bank fees. No pain, all gain. Go to www.trulyfinancial.com/Barry, and Truly is spelled T-R-U-L-Y, and get a free copy of my new book, Change Masters.
Stick around to get your small business unstuck. More of Small Business Radio with Barry Moltz, now on WCPT 820, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
So what was it really like to start a business on the internet way back in the early 90s when it was the new thing and people really weren't quite sure if it was going to be the thing? My next guest is Ron Brock, whose careers included a role as senior product manager at Frito-Lay, where he was responsible for the highly successful launch of nacho cheese flavored Doritos brand tortilla chips. Upon the conclusion of the interactive marketing campaign, he relocated to Phoenix, Arizona, later transitioning to commercial real estate. Seeing the potential of the internet, he discovered an ability to revolutionize commercial real estate. He created the first up-to-minute, searchable, accessible database of multifamily properties, and then included and penned an independent system of classifying real estate property improvements and locations. He's got a new memoir out. It's called The Thicket's Prodigy, The Extraordinary Life of an Improbable Genius. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barry. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate your having me on.
So let's talk about 30 years ago. The internet just came out. It was just publicly available. What'd you think about this thing?
Well, it wasn't so much the internet at the time, because that was sort of a cobbled together piece of work that was done to tie together computer systems, but not in the sense that we know today. What we ran into when Tim Berners-Lee came up with the World Wide Web was first just an opportunity to do some of the things that we had wanted to do in being able to do a searchable database. And that was a very shallow way to look at it. We didn't see the internet at first. That came about as a result of first getting into what we thought would be an easy transition from what we were doing at the moment into using Tim's new World Wide Web.
But I guess, Ron, why get involved at all? Why do you think it was important to put together? I mean, we think about these days, you know, you go on Zillow or some of these other things. Of course, there's a database of all these multifamily properties or, you know, that are available and people can search it. Why do you even think that was going to be a thing? Why was it important for you to do it?
Tim, we were naive and audacious. But the what we discovered when we started to implement the World Wide Web was that it was a totally new system that had to be addressed separately from what we had been doing. It required a form of, pardon me, of computer applications which used a software called sequential language program, which was used to go onto the internet. Well, that was a brand new idea for everybody, and I'm talking about for everyone. That means the people who did software, the programmers, they suddenly got caught off balance because they didn't know SQL. Well, everybody in the world also saw the World Wide Web as being a great way to do various applications that no one had thought of before, and we knew them as .coms. And what we did was first discover that we could not possibly compete with everybody on getting the programming done that we needed in what's called SQL, which resulted in our having to come up with something that would say, we can compete, but we can't compete with these guys on the same basis they're doing, which was using programmers who did not really know what they were doing, but they were charging enormous prices, $185 an hour.
Wow, that was a lot back then.
Really, it was huge. I knew partly into it that we would be broke before we even started. So we decided that, again, just looking at it as a learning process, we hired a college student to learn how to do SQL and paid him while he was learning. We bought the books, gave him the opportunity. He took it on as a serious project and learned how to do SQL programming. Then he did ours, but the difference was they did it for $15 an hour.
Wow.
So that was the beginning of how we got onto the web. Then from that point forward, we had a lot of work to do to get into what we called at that time simply a local change in our database and the application of what was a searchable base. And that's something that we've been working on for a long time.
Right. And it seems that, Ron, that you just jumped in not knowing if you could ever make money at this, right? Did that have its advantages?
Absolutely. You know, you don't do anything, I think, if it's money that you're worrying about, you're probably not going to do it. But if you're looking at something that where you think you're going to innovate, but that's exciting. And I think that's what the entrepreneurial thought process works.
So
we did not think that we would ever fail.
But really what drove you was that this could really be an innovation, and you thought it would be useful, but you didn't think about it would actually make you any money.
Yes, that's correct. It was just going to be an adjunct to what we were doing already. I think the moment that we decided, hey, this has something that we can do, was when we discovered that simply from someone making a comment, well, couldn't you do what you're doing in other markets besides Phoenix? And I thought, yeah, we could. That was when it became the internet to us. The internet actually was not new. It was something that, as you know, probably that had been invented several years prior and claimed to be by politicians.
By Al Gore, of course, right?
Of course, Al Gore, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the internet that, at that time is not the internet that we know. That was Tim Berners-Lee that put that really put that together.
So, Ron, the title of your current book is called The Thicket's Prodigy, The Extraordinary Life and Improbable Genius. Who's the improbable genius?
My father.
So talk about that. Why did you feel you wanted to write a memoir about your dad?
Well, it actually started out, Tim, to be mine. I was going to simply leave information about me, my life, and having pioneered an internet product. In the process of doing it, when you write a memoir about yourself, you're writing about your family as well. And I discovered, actually, I should have known, but it was the first time I really looked into my father's life. He was the designer of the redesigned atomic bomb after the Manhattan Project was complete. Now, he began as a fifth-generation Big Thicket prodigy, I guess. He went to school in a two-room schoolhouse with 9 grades, 1 teacher. His mother was a driving force. He managed to get to high school 8 miles away by mule path. Graduated, had an admittance to Rice Institute, which was the top school in Texas at the time, but had to, for health reasons, go to Texas Tech. He lived through the Depression in Lubbock, Texas, going to school at Texas Tech as a, what people would recall today as a derelict. He was homeless and got a degree in mathematics.
Wow. While he was in college, he was homeless.
He was homeless. One of his stories was when he would sneak into the backyard of some people who had very nice lawn furniture and sleep on that, and then get up early enough that they wouldn't catch him.
So
that was one of his very, very many places that he slept.
So what do you think drove him during that time? Because most folks put in that position would just give up.
His mother was a very bright woman. But they were, you know, in effect, the people in the Big Thicket were like every other area that was very, very low income. And he decided at an early age that he wanted to be an educated man, as he put it. And that was important to him.
So
his mother, I'm sure, was the reason behind it.
So his choice really was to stay home and not get an education, or go to school and not have any place to live.
Well, what it came down to was he did not want to be an East Texas farmer, which is essentially a small farm with a few animals, but mostly it was just working in either the oil industry or the wood cutting. He didn't want to do that. And he was obviously intelligent enough that he understood that that was not a life.
So when he graduated college, what were his next steps?
He actually became a counselor in a very, very low-income settlement house. And then he worked his way up to being a junior high school teacher and then a high school teacher. Then Texas A&M, somehow or other, got in touch with him and offered him the ability to go to school and get additional degrees and at the same time be a teacher. That was just before World War II.
Wow, that's quite the journey.
Well, he was so driven, and he was driven all the way through his life, and he never really he never seemed like the kind of individual that you would say, "Yeah, there's a guy that there's no question he's you don't get in his way," but he was. He ended up after he was in Los Alamos. He was the chief test engineer on the bomb in Yucca Flats in Nevada. Then Texas A&M called him back, and he was a full professor in engineering. That was not challenging enough. So he went into the computer business by accident when he was working at Arizona State as a an assistant to the president. And General Electric was in the process of starting their own computer business, and they happened to acquire a high-powered IBM computer that was installed at Arizona State's engineering school. Dad was heavily involved with the installation and made good friends, I guess, with General Electric. They ended up hiring him. And he went back eventually to Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, where Wernher von Braun and a group of scientists from Germany, who had been involved in the V2 project at Peenemünde. Dad was supposed to be there for 1 month. And when it came time for him to return to Phoenix, Wernher von Braun refused to let him go. He became a more valuable asset to what then was the start of the manned spaceflight program.
Really amazing
then
story.
He returned to Phoenix after 2 years and became a manager of the computer center at General Electric.
Really amazing story. Ron, the last question I wanted to ask you was, what did he think of your achievements?
You know, I'm sure he was proud of it, but we never really talked about that. He was a very stoic guy, which was consistent with what you would expect from the Big Thicket. They were just a group of people that were, whatever was in their way, it was nothing more than an inconvenience. And I guess he just felt that whatever I did was great, and whatever he did was great, but it never was anything that he bragged about. Incidentally, when he was with General Electric in Phoenix again, the government came back to him and said, "We want you to build a computer operation for what will be the manned spaceflight program." So he had a congressional appointment to do that, and he went back to Houston and was manager of computer operations for manned spaceflight.
Pretty amazing.
Until he retired.
Ron, that's all the time we have for this segment. The title of the book is called The Thicket's Prodigy, The Extraordinary Life of an Improbable Genius. Where can people get the book and learn more about what you're doing, Ron?
They can get it from Amazon or from our website, Galt Mirren. GALTMIRRIN.com or Barnes & Noble.
Ron, thanks so much. And I want to thank everyone for joining this week's radio show. I got to thank our sponsor, Truly Financial, banking that puts money back into your business. Get a free copy of my new book, Change Masters, how to actually make the changes you already know you need to make by signing up for an account. Go to www.trulyfinancial.com/Barry. Thanks to our incredible staff, our booking producer, Sarah Schaffrin, our institute producer, Lady B, our marketing manager, Courtney Gilchrist. If you're serious about being more successful in 2023, give me a call. I've set up a private line, 773-837-8250, or email me at barry@maltz.com. Remember, love everyone, trust a few, and paddle your own canoe. Have a profitable and passionate week.
You can find Barry Maltz on the web at barrymaltz.com, or more episodes of Small Business Radio at smallbizradioshow.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.